All right, Wrestling with Theology fans, this is Pastor Doug Minton here to dig a little deeper with you into the book of Revelation. This week, we are looking at Revelation chapter 16, verses 12 through 16, as we look at the sixth bowl of wrath that is poured upon the earth. Last week, we looked at the first five. Next week, we'll look at the seventh bowl. But here we have the preparation for Armageddon, the preparation for the end. So let's look at the text real quick. The sixth angel poured out his bowl on the great river Euphrates, and its water was dried up to prepare the way for the kings from the east. And I saw coming out of the mouth of the dragon and of the mouth of the beast and out of the mouth of the false prophet three unclean spirits like frogs. For they are demonic spirits performing signs who go abroad to the kings of the whole world to assemble them for battle on the great day of God the Almighty. Behold, I am coming like a thief. Blessed is the one who stays awake, keeping his garments on, that he may not go about naked and be seen exposed. And they assembled them at the place that in Hebrew is called Armageddon. All right, so we have this great sign, and one that truly have been terrifying to John, knowing about the great river Euphrates and having it dried up in this bowl of wrath, preparing the way for the kings of the east. So what does all this mean? Well, Dr. Brighton tells us, when the sixth angel sounded his trumpet, he saw a terrifying host gathered and poised at the river Euphrates. This host was about to be unleashed on the human race, and when let loose, it would kill a third of the human population. This evil host is described in such nightmarish terms that is clearly of demonic origin. Here in 16:12-16, John receives a second view of the last battle, but in greater detail as the imagery is developed further. A third and final time, John will see a scene of this last battle when, in connection with the final defeat of the devil, he sees the forces of Gog and Magog destroyed. Now here we have a picture of both the nightmarishness of it, but it goes back to the Exodus, where Moses stretched out his hand over the sea and the Lord caused a great east wind to go and to dry up the land so that the Israelites could pass over. So also in the finality of all things, he will dry up so that the armies can go across. It's very similar also to what happens in Joshua 3, where the Jordan River is dried up so that the Israelites can cross the Jordan River in their preparation for the conquest of the Promised Land. And this will be something that is prophesied by Isaiah in chapter 11, verse 15. And the Lord will utterly destroy the tongue of the sea of Egypt, and he will wave his hand over the river with his scorching breath and strike it into seven channels, and he will lead people across in sandals. So the tongue of the sea of Egypt would be the Red Sea. The river, of course, is the Euphrates. So he is saying that there is going to be nothing blocking the great armies that come. Now, Leon Morris, in the Tyndale Commentary series, talks about this in these words. The Euphrates River was the boundary of the Roman Empire, and for John's readers, the land beyond is a great unknown land. Who could tell what mighty kings lurked there? The Parthians lived in that area, and during the first century, there was a persistent fear that they would invade the empire. This was reinforced by the Nero Redivivus myth, which affirmed that Nero would put himself at the head of the Parthian hordes and march into the empire. John is suggesting that at the end, all these fears and more will be realized. We should bear in mind that Nero and his armies in the myth were not going to ally themselves with Rome, but to attack her. So John is thinking of division among the forces of evil, not a united front. But we would be wrong in holding that he is doing no more than voice a contemporary expectation. By appealing to contemporary fears, he is making the point that at the end of time, the divided forces of evil will engage in a terrible conflict. Curiously, having told us that the way will be cleared for the mighty potentates to march westward, John does not follow this up. He does not say that the kings used the way prepared for them. In fact, he does not mention them again. He simply focuses this verse on the fact that the Euphrates is dried up as a way that makes it easier for them. Now, how do they get there? That's verse 13. I saw coming out of the mouth of the dragon and of the mouth of the beast and out of the mouth of the false prophet, three unclean spirits like frogs. All right, the false prophet here is also the beast from the earth in chapter 13. It will also be the harlot in chapter 17. All of these things will be the same. They are the same image, just taking on a little bit different aspect from one scene to the next. So out of the dragon, the beast, and the false prophet come these unclean spirits that look like frogs. And frogs are a definite unclean animal. I mean, anybody who has held them understands that. Dr. Brighton says the beast from the earth, now called the false prophet, represents all false religions and also the corrupted and apostate elements within the Christian church, so that they may be called Christian, but really are not. Frogs were the second plague in Egypt in Exodus chapter 3 and 4, where God says, the Nile shall swarm with frogs that shall come up into your house and into your bedroom and on your bed, into the houses of your servants and your people, and into your ovens and your kneading bowls. The frogs shall come upon you and your people and on all your servants. Leviticus 11, when talking about some of the things that can be eaten. These you may eat of all that are in the waters, everything in the waters that have fins and scales, whether in the seas or in the rivers you may eat. But anything in the seas or the rivers that does not have fins and scales, or the swarming creatures in the waters and of the living creatures that are in the waters, is detestable to you. You shall regard them as detestable. You shall not eat any of their flesh. You shall detest their carcasses. Frogs live in rivers and streams. They have no fins. They have no scales. They are detestable in the kosher food laws. Thank God the kosher food laws do not pertain to us Christians anymore, because frog legs are yummy. I'm just going to say it. Frog legs are yummy. So to have them as yet one of the other abominations that I do actually enjoy on occasion. No, sorry. I'm just glad I'm not a Jew. And the idea of the unclean spirit coming forth to entice the kings is also nothing new. It goes back to 1 Kings 22, verse 19. Micaiah said, therefore, hear the word of the Lord. I saw the Lord sitting on his throne, and all the host of heaven standing beside him on his right hand and on his left. And the Lord said, who will entice Ahab, that he may go up and fall at Ramoth-Gilead? And one said one thing, and another said another. Then a spirit came forward and stood before the Lord, saying, I will entice him. And the Lord said to him, by what means? And he said, I will go out and will be a lying spirit in the mouth of all his prophets. And he said, you are to entice him, and you shall succeed. Go out and do so. Now therefore, behold, the Lord has put a lying spirit in the mouth of all these your prophets. The Lord has declared disaster for you. And we think, okay, we've got this mass gathering of the spirits of God in heaven before the throne of God. And we have one guy saying, I'll come join a lying spirit in the mouth of all the prophets of Ahab. What's with this? Well, this is not the first time this has happened either. I mean, that we go back to Job chapters 1 and 2, where Satan himself walks into the throne room of God to ask for permission to deal with Job however he wishes. So also, God uses the spirits to bring about the destruction of evil people, and Ahab being one of the more evil people in the Old Testament time, that he was well known for his treachery, and probably, maybe the second most evil person. I'm assuming his wife Jezebel, most people would probably rank her first, because she's the one who kind of needles him at times. But God sends out spirits to lead the evil people into their own destruction, which is exactly what he's allowing here in verse 13. The unclean spirits coming out of the dragon, the beast, and the false prophet, going to entice the nations of the world to gather everybody together so that they may face their own destruction. And verse 14 continues on with this. They are demonic spirits performing signs who go abroad to the kings of the whole world to assemble them for battle on the great day of God the Almighty. This is not going to be the great day of any of these kings. It is the great day of the great King, God the Almighty. Paul writes to Timothy in 1 Timothy 4, "Now the Spirit expressly says that in later times some will depart from the faith by devoting themselves to deceitful spirits and the teachings of demons, through the insincerity of liars whose consciences are seared, who forbid marriage and require abstinence from foods that God created to be received with thanksgiving by those who believe and know the truth." So Paul talks to Timothy about this happening and the searing of the consciences, that the teachings of demons may be promoted even in the church. Jesus says to his disciples in Matthew 24, "If anyone says to you, 'Look, here is the Christ,' or 'There he is,' do not believe it. For false Christ and false prophets will arise and perform great signs and wonders, so as to lead astray, if possible, even the elect. See, I have told you beforehand. So if they say to you, 'Look, he is in the wilderness,' do not go out. If they say, 'Look, he's in the inner rooms,' do not believe it. For as lightning comes from the east and shines as far as the west, so will be the coming of the Son of Man. Where the corpse is, there the vultures will gather." Jesus says, don't look for me in secret places. Don't look for me out in the wilderness. Because as lightning flashes from the east and is seen in the west, so will be the coming of the Son of Man. No one will be able to miss it. And so we have a parenthetical statement from Jesus here in chapter 16. "Behold, I am coming like a thief. Blessed is the one who stays awake, keeping his garments on, that he may not go about naked and be seen exposed." Blessed is he who stays awake. Dr. Brighton says, "The fear of suffering in the battle could be a temptation to surrender to the enemy and thus forfeit Christ's garment and stand naked in one's shame. For this reason, the Lord urges his church in Laodicea to remain clothed in white garments so that the shame of their nakedness would not appear." Chapter 3, verse 18. So this idea of being naked and exposed is because people have wandered away from the faith. And on the day of his coming, they will be seen as naked and ashamed because they are not clothed in the robe of Christ's righteousness. Now we conclude verse 16. "They assembled them at the place that in Hebrew is called Armageddon." Finally, we get Armageddon mentioned in Revelation. And Dr. Brighton reminds us that this may not be exactly one particular place, because he says the Hebrew Har Megiddo means mountain of Megiddo, though most translations just transliterate it into English as Armageddon. Some manuscripts of Revelation, mostly the Byzantine family, have Magdawan, which would be a reference to the ancient city of Megiddo, but not to the mountain of Megiddo. Near this ancient Canaanite city, by the waters of Megiddo, Barak and Deborah and the Israelites defeated Sisera and his host in Judges 5. Josiah was killed and his army defeated by Pharaoh Necho at Megiddo in 2 Kings 23 and 2 Chronicles 35. As an ancient Canaanite city, Megiddo was situated on the north side of the Carmel Ridge of hills and was thus strategically situated in a commanding position overlooking the mountain pass between the coastal plain and the valley of Esdraelon. Mounts declares it is one of history's famous battlefields, having witnessed major conflicts all the way from one fought by Thutmose III in 1468 BC to that of Lord Allenby of Megiddo in 1917. So we have here this area and why it is deemed such a important place in people's minds is because there have been battles fought there in that vicinity for millennia. I mean, 1468 BC all the way up to Lord Allenby in World War I. And likely there has been battles in that area since, because that area is always a volatile area. But nothing compares to what is going to happen at the Battle of Armageddon, which, spoiler alert here, we don't talk about just yet. Because when we get to the seventh bowl, we hear those famous words from God once again, "It is done." The great day of God the Almighty is there, and no one can stand. unless they are in him. But that is what we will talk about next week. Until then, this is Pastor Doug Minton, thanking you for being here, standing with me as we dig deeper into Revelation, getting into Armageddon a little bit. We will get into it a little more later on when it shows up again. But here it is, prepared and ready to go. John will show us the rest of it later. But until then, he gives us this to strengthen us so that we may wrestle with the theologies around us. Maybe not the battle of Armageddon, but definitely the battles in our lives. Amen.